Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The President's draft plan for the Pacific Northwest forests is met with disappointment from all sides, but this is good news for the White House. Also this time, In Search of a Land Ethic with author William Least Heat Moon.
I think so many times environmental sense and sensibility, they begin with self-pride. And not the kind of pride that destroys things, the kind of pride that says, these things have happened before us, and we care enough about them, we're proud enough of them, to make sure that we preserve them in an intelligent way.
The Environment Show, a national production, made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. The question now is, will the plan save any part of life in the Pacific Northwest? Following the April Timber Summit, President Clinton pledged to adopt a plan to protect both the wilderness and the timber industry well into the future. A sustainable plan. Now we have it. The plan calls for a significant reduction in the amount of timber cut, 1.2 billion board feet a year, down from 5 billion board feet a year just 10 years ago. Though the timber industry will sustain job loss with this cutback, it is hoped the new, lower level of cutting will allow forests to regenerate and thus the timber industry to survive essentially forever, albeit on a smaller scale. That's the hope, anyway. Vic Scher, managing attorney with the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund in Seattle, is hopeful.
The bottom line is that the president has directed his agencies to tell the truth, save the ecosystem, and obey the law. And that's a major, major change from what we've seen over the last 12 years with the Reagan and Bush administrations. So that's a big step forward at all, the fact that the president was willing to come out to Portland in April and meet with all of the various folks who are affected by the forest management policies of the federal government, and the fact that he's told his scientists to actually do something that should be worthwhile.
Scher says few details of the plan are available yet, so it is difficult to judge the viability of what the scientists have advised the president to do. Scher was among the invited guests at the table during the Forest Summit last April and says there were two developments at the summit that appear in the plan just released.
The first is that the federal government is finally trying to approach the forests as complete ecosystems. They're not looking just at the spotted owl or at the marbled murrelet, but they're looking at those species and the hundreds of others that depend on the forest and that don't live anywhere else and that are affected by logging. The second point is that they're looking at the economic interests, or rather the economic issues, as system problems as well. And that means looking not just at the timber industry and the short-term jobs and profits that may be available there, but at what's going to be needed for the long-term health of the region. And that includes economic diversification and job transition for many people.
Recognizing that 1.2 billion board feet a year necessarily means some jobs will be lost as mills either slow down or shut down, President Clinton has proposed that Congress invest $1.2 billion over 5 years for job retraining and general economic assistance for the region. For some, however, to say the plan misses the mark is an understatement.
It has serious deficiencies. In fact, it's a catastrophic proposal.
James Geisinger, president of the Northwest Forestry Association in Portland, Oregon.
I was at the April 2nd Forest Conference, and I distinctly heard the president commit to the people of the Northwest to find a balanced solution. And the proposal that he announced last Thursday isn't either of those things. It certainly isn't balanced, and in fact, it's not even a solution.
How so?
Well, he promised to get us out of the courtroom and into the conference room, to use his very words. And yet his proposal puts this issue squarely back in a federal district court in Seattle, Washington. If his intent on April 2nd was to do nothing more than satisfy Judge Dwyer, then we didn't have to go through this exercise of the last 90 days trying to raise people's expectations that they were going to come out with something any better. And relative to balance, his proposal would reduce our timber supply from federal forests by about 80%, lock up over 15 million acres of land, eliminate about 85,000 jobs and result in the closure of multi-million-dollar manufacturing facilities that dozens of rural communities in the Northwest have depended on for decades. That's not a balanced solution.
Judge Dwyer, Geisinger refers to, is Judge William Dwyer of the Federal District Court in Seattle. It has been Dwyer who, over the years, has heard and ruled on various cases seeking to curb, if not halt, logging to protect endangered species, most notably the northern spotted owl. In addition to specifying a reduced level of cutting, the plan also calls for a change in cutting techniques. In certain areas, the practice of clear cutting will be replaced by selective cutting, where only certain trees are cut, leaving the rest. Also in the plan, certain areas critical to endangered species, including the spotted owl, certain of these areas will be off limits to cutting, except to allow the taking of dead, dying, or diseased trees. The overall plan is to provide for both a healthy, long-term forest and a healthy, long-term logging industry based on the rich natural resources contained in those forests. To ban all cutting would kill the industry. Allowing unlimited cutting would kill the forest. However, Geisinger, whose organization represents nearly 100 forest products businesses in the Pacific Northwest, says the president's plan does not achieve its goal.
Well, at the Forest Conference, we advocated ecosystem management in its purest sense, and that is the management of entire ecosystems, applying management techniques across broad landscapes. What the team of scientists have proposed and that the president endorsed was to simply take past resource management plans and overlay one level of constraints after another on top of those decisions that have been made in the past to protect other species, and it resulted in a very small amount of land being left over for timber management. What we'd like to see the administration endorse is to go back to the drawing board and allow the resource management agencies of this country to reconstitute their management plans to take those multitude of resources that you referred to and manage them in an integrated, cohesive way. What President Clinton has advocated is the essential lockup or near lockup of about 15 million acres of land and leaving about 7 million acres that would be managed with just the lightest of touches on the landscape, which has resulted in dramatically lower harvest levels in our estimation that are largely unacceptable and unnecessary.
Timothy Egan is a lifelong resident of the Pacific Northwest and author of The Good Rain, a 1990 novel subtitled Across Time and Terrain in the Pacific Northwest. Egan is also Seattle bureau chief of the New York Times, and his articles on the Pacific Northwest can be seen on a regular basis. He steps back from the debate table now to put things in a little better perspective.
You have to consider the past in order to understand what's really being done here. You have to remember that in the 1980s, they cut more trees than had ever been cut at any time in history, more than 5 billion board feet a year out of the Pacific Northwest. Now, in the early 1980s, there was an assistant secretary of agriculture who said what he wanted to do was to eliminate all old growth forests left in the national forest. That would essentially eliminate all old growth forests left in the United States because most of these forests are on public land. So you had a policy a little more than 10 years ago that was to wipe out what was left of these ancient forests. And then that was followed throughout the mid-1980s. They severely overcut. They got to a point where not just spotted owls, but literally hundreds of species of Chinook salmon, different types of birds, lynxes, all kinds of creatures were in deep, deep trouble. The whole ecology of this area was literally unraveling. So they were forced into a situation where they were sort of had to pay a debt or pay an ecological debt from the past. So what you have is, I think there's something long range here. I think there's something that could end up being visionary. At this time right now, it looks terrible to people who live in timber communities. It looks terrible to some environmentalists who wanted larger forest reserves that were inviolate. But what it may actually do is, A, change the direction of the Forest Service, B, change the way we look at these forests. We're managing them now for their lifeblood, for their salmon streams, for their watersheds. And see, it does make the hard decision. If we'd gone on the path of the past and hadn't done anything, there wouldn't be any timber jobs in the national forest here in another 10, 15 years, and there wouldn't be any old growth left either.
What have you been hearing vis-a-vis reaction to the president's plan from all sides of who would be affected by it?
Well, they tell you one thing publicly, and they tell you another thing privately. Publicly, both sides are denouncing this. The timber industry is saying, we can't live with this. We're going to try to fight it. Of course, they really can't fight it unless they change the Endangered Species Act, because that's what's driving this thing. The conservationists are saying, we want stricter protection of these reserves. We don't like the fact that there are no, that you could still maybe logging there. In other words, they say, what if a new administration comes in 4 years and decides they want to just open up these reserves? They aren't set in stone. They want that. But privately, what a lot of loggers have told me is that, look, we know this thing is ramping down. It's better to have some finality to it and some predictability. We know now through this plan, at least we're going to get some timber. Before, we didn't know one way or the other whether it was going to be a lot 1 year or none the next, because we'd be tied up in court. We at least will know we'll have some predictability and we can start moving on with our lives. Now, in the congressional delegation here in the Northwest, they are also denouncing it, saying it can't work, and sort of playing to their constituents. But what they tell you behind the scenes is that this is the only plan we've got, and we think it's going to fly.
Timothy Egan, Seattle bureau chief of the New York Times and author of The Good Rain, a book about the history and mythology of the Pacific Northwest. Vic Schur is managing attorney for the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, and James Geisinger is president of the Northwest Forestry Association. The plan as such is only now a draft plan. The federal courts must look into it to check for compliance with federal environmental protection laws, and the public will have until the end of December to examine and offer comments. We're not out of the woods yet. This is Bruce Robertson. The more technologically advanced we get, the more we realize the value of the way we used to do things. Take, for example, the way we cut tall grass. Today, we use all manner of motorized tools to whack down the stalks. But Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, says there is a better way, a really old-fashioned way. He wants to show us. Let's see, I think he's down here in his basement garden workshop. Yep, here he is. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Bruce.
How you doing?
How are you
doing there?
Well, I'm sharpening the blade on my old scythe. Instead of using the power equipment to cut brush out in the out in my property, I like to use this old scythe. You know, I'm sitting on this. I'm sitting on an old wheel, stone. I'm sharpening this thing. Nothing like having a good sharp blade when you're going to go out and cut some brush.
So tell me about this particular scythe here. This is a really beautiful, almost an antique. It looks old.
I would say this is an antique because this was my wife's grandfather's. And he would have been about 90-something now, and he was the superintendent of grounds at the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery down in along the Hudson River. And this was the scythe that he used to clear the land up here where I live near Hollowville. And it's about a 6-acre orchard, and this is what he used to clear the land when he built his house up here about 30 years ago.
You can still get scythes, modern scythes, can't you?
Yeah, you can get them in catalogs like the A.M. Leonard catalog or sometimes at hardware stores and home centers. But nowadays, they're made out of aluminum. A lot of them have aluminum snaith, which is the handle, really. That's the name for the handle. And I like this old-fashioned wooden kind of snaith because I think it's a lot more interesting and antique, and it's got the nice little wooden handles, which are called nibs, and it just has a nice burnished wood feel. It's really kind of an 18th century kind of thing to have.
Let's go out and see how it works.
Great. I'm looking forward to it. I always like to do it. I like to hang it over my shoulder so I look kind of like Father Time when I do this.
Okay, we're going to find a little patch here to give it a test.
Yeah.
Okay.
So like I said before when we were sharpening this, it's a kind of a body motion, a rhythm. You can't just do it with your arms and your shoulder. You have to twist your whole body sort of at the waist. Otherwise, if you were going to do 10 acres or 20 acres like those farmers out in Kansas are doing about now, you'd wear yourself out real soon if you just used your shoulders. So give me a little room here.
Okay, I'll give you a little room.
Yep, and
see what happens
get
here.
Get the handle set up just right. It all takes a little technique. This blade could be a little sharper. But you can see we're cutting through grass here that's about 3 feet high, and it hasn't been cut for the whole year, and it's pretty stiff, but it's coming right down. And you can get pretty darn close. You can get within 2 or 3 inches of the ground. I mean, but before there were lawnmowers, this is what the people used to use to cut their grass on the manors of England and, I guess, Virginia and places like that where they had lawns back in the old days. See, it doesn't take long to get through here.
Well, listen, Larry, I never like to get in the way of your hard work, so we'll leave you be and catch up with you next time.
All right, well, let me give a few more swats at this thing. And
don't wear yourself out now.
I know, it's hot today, so I don't want to get too worn out.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. He reaps his fields and lawns around his home in Hollowville, New York. This is Bruce Robertson. Listen to the land, and it will tell you. It will tell you what's right and what's wrong with the way you are living on it. But you have to listen. This is what author William Least Heat Moon learned in preparing his epic work, Prairie Earth. John Rowan explains.
And they do perceive that prairie as a magnificent place to live. They love living there. Whereas so many people who come through Chase County on Interstate 35, which nicks the corner of it, go through there, and their response is the first time they see it, "My God, what if you had to live here? This is hell's half acre out here. There's nothing here. It's just grass and hills. How do people stand it?"
Chase County in the Flint Hills of eastern Kansas may not seem like a mythic place, a grand canyon or a walled in pond, but by the time you've turned the last page in William Least Heat Moon's Prairie Earth, you may feel the need to visit the region, located 50 miles northeast of Wichita.
Once a person who comes from the woodlands makes his peace with this treeless land, you begin to fall in love with the incredible horizon, the skies, and the grasses where they're not eaten all to hell.
The book, Prairie Earth, is divided into 12 sections, one for each topographical quadrangle in the county. These quadrangles do more than just organize Heat Moon's numerous facts and insights. They link the literal and the literary.
And it happened to take 12 of those maps to cover most of Chase County. And thinking of this number 12, that's classically the number of books in an epic poem. It's a classic number for organizing works around. I thought, okay, what if I worked with 12? And then I looked at the number of topics that I had, and it worked out that if I broke those down into 6 categories, almost everything I had fit in there. So it seemed a natural.
From the sea of local history in Chase County, he nets episodes which illustrate broader concerns.
When a writer goes after particular details, as I try to do in all of my work, really get the details right, which makes the work more specific, a strange kind of thing seems to happen in the mind of the reader, and that is these details, strangely enough, instead of they do make it more specific, but they also seem to make the work more universal, not only in place, but in time. In other words, James Agee in Let Us Now Praise Famous Man is writing about one small area of a county in Alabama, but what he says pertains to the entire country, if not the entire nation. Faulkner, writing about his mythical county, Yoknapatawpha in Mississippi, it's a universal county. So I was very much interested in trying to get Chase County, Kansas, in the Flint Hills, in the Tallgrass Prairie, down specifically with the hope that those specifics actually would give that place a universality.
Heat Moon's drive toward universality is more than just literary cleverness. We all, he says, can find ways to better appreciate our local landscapes.
The subtitle of Prairie Earth is a deep map. Part of the idea that I wanted to convey about this idea of a deep map, first of all, is that every place is a deep map. And if this little Kansas county that seems on the surface to be almost sterile, to be the kind of place that most Americans do not want to live, if I could establish, so I believed, that that county has a deep history, that it belongs to part of a deep map, then I assume that readers across the rest of the country would understand, if they don't already, that their own particular terrain no matter how big it is, no matter where it is, has its own deep map also.
The Flint Hills of Kansas were formed by a Permian Sea 250 million years ago. Today, the land and people of the region are what they are and are who they are because of that Permian Sea. The cows that ranchers run on the prairie and the resulting local economy draw on a bank account of incredibly old rocks, minerals, and soil. The immediate land stewardship issue Heat Moon considers is cattle grazing. One of the characters in the book confides that if you leave it to us, we'll eat the hell out of this grass. The cattle will overgraze. Although Heat Moon says there is growing awareness of the need for sound environmental conservation practices,
many of them have not yet have come to understand that good pasture management, and that's usually what they call the prairies. They very rarely use the word prairie. They call it pasture. Good pasture management must now invoke environmental means that they have been hostile to in some ways in the past. But many of them, especially the young ones, are beginning to understand that good stewardship means embracing sound environmental policies. Their own economic livelihood depends upon them becoming environmentalists, which is a word, by the way, that most of them despise.
In fact, resistance to such labels and fear of outside intervention resulted in federal cancellation of a proposal to establish an 11,000-acre tall grass prairie national park in Chase County, a cancellation Heat Moon considers a loss for both Kansas and the nation.
It seems to me that of all the great historical forces that have shaped this country, nothing is more overwhelming than the Great Western Movement. This motion of people from east to west. And you see that topographically, no place more clear than movement across the prairies. You can see it no place more clearly than in reading the many, many accounts that the pioneers, the settlers left of their crossing of this prairie. I mean, it's history embodied there to go through this tall grass prairie. But it's very difficult today to get the sense that they had. They talk again and again and again in their reports, the early crosses of the prairie, about the sea of grass, the ocean of grass. That's a cliche that comes up in almost all of their accounts. I think that mainly what they're referring to when they speak of the ocean of grass, the sea of grass, is the movement of wind across tall grass prairie, where the wind moves the grass so that it looks like the billows of the sea. I think 11,000 acres out of the millions of acres that the Tallgrass Prairie once had, 11,000 acres is not too much to let a young person, a young American today, go out and walk in grass that stretches above her or his head.
Though Heat Moon personally would love to see a Tallgrass Prairie Park or any number of other environmental protection measures, in the end he believes it is the people, in this case the people of Chase County, who must decide.
I think what the book has helped the people do, first of all, is to realize that their own little piece of turf there, their terrain, their territory, is important. They realize that their history is not only significant, but that it's a fascinating and in many ways beautiful history. It's also ugly in places. I think so many times real environmental sense and sensibility, they begin with self-pride. And not the kind of pride that destroys things, the kind of pride that says, these things have happened before us, and we care enough about them, we're proud enough of them, to make sure that we preserve them in an intelligent way.
William Least Heat Moon, author of Prairie Earth, A Deep Map, published by Houghton Mifflin. He spoke to us from member station KOPN in Columbia, Missouri. This is John Rowan.
Well, that's our report on the Environment Show this week. Thanks much to John Rowan for the story with William Least Heat Moon. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 184. The Environment Show, a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.